Show Me the Way, Episode 9, the Texas Managed Equity Acquisition. I get to say this because it's Mike Waters I'm interviewing from East Texas, but now a transplanted Kansas Cityan, and he loves this place. This episode, we're going to talk with Mike about his life experiences, including his involvement with a private-owned company that he sold, and his new venture, a private equity-owned business by the name of Continental Disc Corporation. Welcome to Show Me the Way. This is a podcast presented and sponsored by Spencer Fain, LLP, about business succession planning, the merger and acquisition experience, and successful exits. I am your host, Dave Sider. Joining me on today's show is Mike Waters, and as the introduction suggests, a Texan and currently the CEO of Continental Disc Corporation, a company with an international reach. As well, Mike, I have known Mike for a while, was involved with multiple companies previously. Why I wanted to have Mike on today's show is to ask him to share his secrets on successfully growing a business on behalf of a private ownership group and how he helped and arranged for that ultimate exit. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dave.
First of all, let's get the Texas part out of the way. Tell us about Texas. Tell us about growing up in Texas. Tell us about East Texas and Texas A&M, the school you attended.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, as you mentioned, I was born in East Texas, a little town called Nacogdoches. It's actually the oldest town in Texas. And my parents were students at Stephen F. Austin State University there in Nacogdoches when they got married, and I was born there and lived there in my early childhood. And we moved when I was fairly young to Bryan, Texas, which is just in southeast Texas. And I really grew up and graduated from high school in Bryan. And Bryan is pretty close to College Station, Texas, where Texas A&M University is located. And I attended Texas A&M as an undergraduate and graduated from the College of Engineering there. And while there, I was in the Corps of Cadets, and I really credit the Corps of Cadets with teaching me leadership skills, the importance and the skills around time management, certainly around discipline, and I really learned that respect is earned based on your behavior and your achievements, and it's not bestowed upon you. And just an amazing environment is the Corps of Cadets to develop leaders for the future, for the military as well as industry. And I really appreciate my time there. When I graduated from A&M, I was very fortunate to have been recruited from on campus by Emerson Electric. It's about a $50 billion publicly traded company. It's actually headquartered over in St. Louis. And I was a part of the Rosemount Measurement and Control Division, which is headquartered in Minneapolis. I spent about 9 months in Minneapolis as a part of their engineering trainee program, and then ultimately ended up back in Houston where I began my career. So I've been working in some aspect of process automation, either in an operational leadership role, commercial roles, or even for a while as an end user leading manufacturing pretty much my entire career.
What is it about, this is kind of an aside, what is it about Texas A&M and the Corps of Cadets? What can you give us, like, three things that changed your life? Because I've always been fascinated by it and whether I should have gone somewhere where they had some kind of a military background, or at least my parents, I think, felt that way.
Yeah. So A&M is kind of unique. We commission more officers in the military than any other university in the nation other than the military academies.
Wow.
So, you know, behind only the military academies is Texas A&M. A number of the people that are in the Corps Cadets, and this ended up being myself, were there for the experience, for the challenge. So my freshman year, I was in Squadron 11 in the third wing of the Corps, and we started our
freshman year with 22 freshman cadets, and 16 of us made it all the way through our senior year. And those guys are still some of my best friends in the world, the guys that I went through the Corps of Cadets with.
And just a tremendous experience in supporting one another and overcoming challenges, you know, mental and physical, while at the same time, by the way, trying to succeed in a relatively challenging university environment on top of everything. And, you know, you really have to learn to be good at managing your time. You have to learn to be good at thinking fast and remembering important bits of data that you might be called upon to recite at any given time, and as well as deal with the physical challenge of sometimes just literal exhaustion, but still maintain a sharp mind and attend class and be able to succeed. There are so many things in my life that may become easier to me than would otherwise. It's probably difficult for me to even recognize that anymore because it's so much a part of what I am. But I have tremendous respect for that experience and for what it meant to me. And some of my best friends on this earth are guys that I went through the Corps Cadet experience with. And so, you know, that binding of people together, I think, is ultimately what you see reflected in the broader support for the university and just the feeling that a lot of Aggies have for their university.
My sense is, based upon those statements, your time in college at A&M has had a huge impact. It maybe is the foundation by which you were able to go forward into business and the success you've achieved.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true, Dave. You know, again, some of these things occur to you, you know, so subtly and so slowly over a period of time. It's an evolution of confidence, an evolution of discipline, an evolution of, you know, grit that you may not recognize it as a step change right in your life at any one time. But with the benefit of hindsight, you can look back at times prior and just see the difference that it made.
Excellent. Let's talk now a little bit about your current business. What is Continental Disc all about?
Sure. So Continental Disc Corporation is really made up of four brands. Continental Disc, a company called Groth Corporation, G-R-O-T-H, not Groth with a W, Lamont Disc and Lamont Valve and Arrestor. And all of those products are in one way, shape, or form involved in pressure protection within the process industry. So we're involved in protecting a vessel from overpressurizing and ultimately rupturing, you know, at some risk to plant and personnel. But also rupture discs, which is our primary product line, are used in a variety of industries in everything from food and beverage to commercial aerospace to defense to general industry. And one of the things that attracted me to Continental Disc was the diversity in the end use markets. I've spent a significant portion of my career being very much tethered to the ups and downs of the oil and gas industry. And the opportunity to take, you know, my experiences and be able to apply those across a broader end use market was very attractive to me. So I joined Continental Disc in July of 2021 as the chief executive officer. We have manufacturing locations in Liberty, Missouri, which is in the Kansas City metro, as you know, David, Stafford, Texas, which is a suburb of Houston, and Ahmedabad in India. And then we have distribution for our European markets from an office in the Netherlands, in Leiden. Continental Disc was acquired by Tenecom, a New York City-based private equity group, in January of 21, and I was brought in by them to lead the company under the new ownership.
Hey, thanks for that current update. Let's go back. Let's take a step back a little bit. You were involved with some prior businesses, most notably one in Arizona. How did you get involved in that? Why did you get involved? And what was your strategy as far as joining that operation? And if you could, what were the results?
Sure. So I joined a company, a Phoenix-based company called Flow Management Devices LLC in October 2019 as their president. And that business is what we refer to as a low volume, high mix, or high value. So each individual unit had a very high value, producing very highly engineered products for the liquid hydrocarbon pipeline industry. So I was recruited to FlowMD, or FMD as we call them, by a former colleague. I used to work for a business called Circor Energy. And the gentleman that's currently the vice president of sales for FlowMD and I worked together at Circor Energy. FlowMD is a privately held business owned by a small ownership group, mostly participants in the business. And sadly, the founder and majority owner has some pretty significant health issues and realized that he needed to step down. And he decided to sell the business, and he was looking for someone that had experience in M&A, but also who understood the products, and he understood the importance of someone who had had experience with highly engineered products for the oil and gas space. And, you know, quite flatteringly, my former colleague thought of me, and I was brought in as the new president with a very specific objective of preparing the business for and taking it through a sell process. So we engaged an investment banking resource to represent us on the sales side. I came in, we put together the confidential information memorandum, or the SIM, as some of your listeners will recognize. We sent that out to over 100 companies, a combination of strategics and sponsor companies, and we received about 43 indications of interest, or IOIs, back as a response to the SIM. And from there, we selected 16 of those organizations to bring in for management presentations. And we went through the MP rounds in a very accelerated manner. I don't know that I would recommend any of your listeners to do 16 management presentations over about a 4-week period. But we did. And after the MP rounds, we shortlisted down to three companies. It was two strategics, public companies, and one sponsor company. It was a private equity group. And ultimately, we entered into exclusive negotiation with IDEX Corporation, IDEX, which is a publicly traded company based out of Chicago. We entered into exclusivity with them in January of 2020. And we went through an accelerated due diligence process and closed on February 28th of 2020. And I always make mention of the fact when I share that story that February 28th of 2020 was right on the cusp of the world shutting down for COVID. And on March 12th, you know, most businesses that were non-essential were shut down and the world really stopped turning. So we were extremely fortunate to have concluded the deal prior to that shutdown. So our strategy for the business and how we were able to get that done was really built around three pillars. And, you know, I would say if I'm providing a takeaway for your listeners, it's, you know, think about what is the true value of the business and how do you tell that story to somebody that may not really understand all the nuts and bolts, but they know they want to make a good investment. So we really built a story around three pillars. And I apologize if some of this sounds is very specific to the subject matter, but I want to share this. You know, one was we expressed that we could continue to capture market share in the domestic market based on technical superiority of the product. We just literally made a better product, and that was a story we were able to tell. And that was a story we were able to demonstrate. We were getting about 75% of new orders in the domestic market. Wow. Secondly, there was an opportunity around technology transfer. So there was a competing methodology for doing what we did with our products that was really more mature and less effective than the product we built. So there was a large existing market that was available through technology transfer. And then lastly, we had an enormous global market that was relatively unexploited. And we did a very good job of identifying, categorizing, and sizing each of those distinct market opportunities. And we just told a great story. And ultimately, you know, we were able to expedite the transaction.
And you were a part owner of that business. Is that correct?
I wasn't an equity partner because I came in closer to the time that the business was going to be sold. You know, I had a meaningful success bonus tied to the completion of the transaction. And that was enough to keep me motivated to bring it to a successful and speedy conclusion.
Share with me, if you would, and with the listeners, what did you learn from that experience? Because my understanding is before that, you were president of another company, not an owner. And then you went to a situation where you're president of the company or CEO, and you had the equivalency, for lack of a better term, of equity. So what did you learn from that experience that you could share that maybe is unique to your situation in being an owner as well as a president of a company? Because you're wearing two hats, right?
That's right. And, you know, it's very interesting. So you're exactly right. So the prior company I was with was called SOR Controls Group. It was a family-owned business that was in second-generation family leadership, and I was the chief executive officer for SOR Controls Group. Moving from that business that was really in a what I would describe as a very stable environment, and, you know, no longer pursuing aggressive growth either organically or inorganically, moving from that environment to an aggressive, time-constrained objective to transact the business was just entirely different. And of course, at the same time, I'm trying to run the business and maintain the market share and maintain our standing within the space. And so there's a lot of long nights and a lot of long days because we would be tied up with the potential acquirers for most of the day. And then really, I'd spend the evening in the office trying to catch up on the day work before doing it again the next day. So, you know, the advice that I would pass along to your listeners based on that, you know, what I think we did really well, and I referenced this just a bit ago, is prepare the story. I think a lot of times there's an assumption that the organizations who may have expressed an interest in acquiring a business come to the table with a greater understanding of the value proposition than they actually have. I mean, typically they will have a broad understanding of the industry space and a broad understanding of the product position, or they wouldn't be there at the table with interest. But really helping to crystallize the nature of the opportunity, I think, is very important. You know, help them to see and understand the upside. And, you know, in some cases, I also think an owner-operator is, you know, they're almost more interested in talking about what a good job they've done versus painting the picture of what the upside looks like under new ownership. And ultimately, you want that acquirer to feel comfortable that, you know, that they've built a pro forma that's solid and that their risk profile is very low.
You know, to your point, I've seen a lot of times in acquisitions, somebody will put together a playbook or a pitch book, you know, whatever that would be. Did you go outside the company to bring in experts, consultants to help you to prepare for that presentation, or did you do that all internally?
Yes, Dave, we did. We used Stifel Nicolaus out of New York to advise us on the sales side. They did a really great job of packaging the message for consumption, if you will, and building out the financial projections. And I would actually recommend bringing in an advisor for any of your clients that have a deal with any scale and sophistication to it, because they were a big part of helping us expedite the overall process.
But in terms of the strategic pillars that would underpin that growth, we developed those all internally. And I would say that's where the best thinking is going to come from. You know, some of your listeners and some organizations may want to seek outside help to cosmetically prepare the data for consumption. But I would say the deepest understanding and the opportunities for the company are going to come from the people inside the company.
I mean, who's going to know better than yourself in those situations?
That's my opinion as well.
Yeah.
That's my opinion as well.
So what lessons do you take from your prior experiences? Let's think about all of these different businesses from the very beginning until now. What do you find that you're bringing to your current company that allows you to march forward with their goals and their strategy?
That's a great question. You know, maybe this goes back to what I said earlier about, you know, developing discipline and you know, developing an understanding of leadership and the importance of clarity of communication, et cetera. So I kind of have a little playbook that I've relied upon at multiple stops through my professional journey. And I start with mission, vision, and values, understanding what do we want to be when we grow up? What are the pieces that we have to play with? And what is the opportunity to exploit those pieces and resources to their maximum value? So once you kind of have a detailed understanding of the product lines and the markets and, you know, what are we trying to do from a brand perspective? Are we trying to be the cost leader? Are we trying to be the technology leader? Are we trying to be the leader in customer service or some combination of those? So once you've established what that mission is, then you pivot to evaluating the team. Do I have the right people to accomplish the mission? And do I have the right people in the right seats, in the right roles? And are they organized and authorized to be able to execute to the maximum of their capability? So once you know what you're trying to do and you've got the right people in place, then I think the next important thing is to start developing processes, right? You develop discipline around execution in the most efficient manner, in the most lean manner. So processes for budgeting, processes for planning, for project tracking, for new product development, sales inventory operation planning, and all these things have to work together to create a lean, efficient organization that is communicating appropriately across the different areas of the organization. And process, in my experience, is a really important element of that. So once that's complete, you've got, you know what you want to be when you grow up, you got the right people in the right place, you got processes that support their efficient execution, then you can really become aggressive about capital deployment, whether it's for organic growth or inorganic growth, investing in automation, investing in acquisitions, expansion geographically, all those kind of things. And then ultimately, that leads to the opportunity for enterprise integration. So you're integrating new acquisitions, you're integrating new information gathering, you're integrating teams. And, you know, and I always fall back on an annual strategy deployment process. So not just deciding what our strategy is, but what are we going to go do about it? I've been a part of and observed a lot of organizations that they actually spend quite a bit of money and time going through strategy development, and then they all go back to work and do exactly what they were doing before. You know, there's no deployment. Yeah. So I try to be pretty disciplined about creating and managing strategy deployment. You know, and ultimately, you just need to have a plan. Make it simple to understand and over-communicate it to the organization. And, you know, I think that's really the core of my playbook is understand the business through creating that mission, vision, and values, have the right people, have the right processes, and just work the heck out of that plan.
Very good. I don't think, though, you learned that at A&M. That is something that you developed experientially or other education or training.
Yeah. You know what? I tell you, that's a great comment. And it's very astute. And what I've said, I've just had the great good fortune of working for some fantastic companies and working with some fantastic people. And I've been able to take the things that I really like, that I see that work, and I carry them with me to the next experience. And those things that don't add as much value, I leave them behind. And over time, you've worked that tool into just an efficient machine. And that's what I think has helped me.
Good for you. You know, here's a little twist here I want to give you. You've been involved, I'm sure, on both sides of M&As, buying and selling. So you've seen some successes. Have you seen some, not so much failures, but maybe some challenges that you would say to people, I would avoid this or that in going through the process, hurdles or you know, some type of disconnect? You know, maybe you've seen some acquisitions that failed too. And I'm probably talking about outsiders or third parties where you've watched and you go like, well, why did they do that? Well, that didn't work out, so to speak.
Yeah, I would say a couple of things, Dave, in response to that. One is, and I have experienced this as most common with large, diverse strategics, you know, industrial conglomerates. Right. In many cases, there are companies that think they know better than everybody. Right. And they're coming in hell-bent to apply their model, and they look at a well-oiled machine and assume they can make it better. And sometimes the entrepreneurial mind has actually created the maximum value, and the opportunity is to further expose that to a broader market, but not change it. And so I would say one pitfall is strategics that always build, you know, 20% cost reduction or 20% overhead reduction into their pro forma because they just assume they can make it happen without having identified it on the front end. You know, the other thing that I've experienced is, you know, the need to really evaluate infrastructure and cost structure in the due diligence period, because I've been a part of multiple acquisitions where, you know, right after you close, you find out you got to add 3 or 4 incremental headcount, or, you know, everybody was chronically undercompensated, and, you know, the cost structure that you've built into your pro forma goes out the window. So I have come to really start with a clean sheet of paper when building the cost structure rather than purely relying on what's in place. You know, on the sell side, I think I would just repeat something I said earlier, is really put the time in to develop the plan and tell the story, and don't assume that the acquirer will be able to assemble the chapters of that story on their own. Help get them to the end zone, if you will.
Yeah, that's really a good point, because you're right. A lot of entrepreneurs I know are very, very proud of their business.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
And, you know, it's difficult for them to project how to put the business out for sale in a way that is most meaningful for the buyer. Not true with everyone, but most of the time it's difficult because, you know, again, you're myopic.
Yeah, I think that's well put. You know, that actually brings to mind something that I think we did really well with FlowMD, is rather than make kind of a one-to-one pitch to the teams that were brought in, we assembled a real tiger team of subject matter experts to make that pitch. And we assigned very formally the different segments of the pitch to those subject matter experts. And that really, accomplished two things. One is you had absolutely the most knowledgeable people communicating with the potential acquirers. And number two, it gives the potentially acquiring company an opportunity to see the value of the team, the quality of the team. And ultimately, that's a part of what they're buying. You know, they're not just buying the intellectual property. They're buying an understanding of the market. They're buying an understanding of the competition. And we, I think, demonstrated that very effectively through the team approach that we took to presenting the business.
Well, to your point, especially in 2022, people are an uncommon asset. There's not enough of them out there, you know, at the end of the day, and they're probably your best salesman for what you're trying to go forward with. The struggle is, how do you put them there and tell them, hey, I'm going to be selling the business, which means there's going to be major disruption, which then causes, you know, even senior executives anxiety. How did you deal with that?
You know, I think what we did pretty well, and you're exactly right, it necessitates bringing more people inside the tent, if you will. What I think we did a pretty good job of is communicating that the transaction was going to occur, and the benefit to active and effective participation is a better outcome for the business, a better outcome for the individuals professionally and personally. And really, we had interests that were all aligned. And, you know, if you don't have people you can trust, you probably got a number of other problems anyway. But, you know, it's interesting. I was just reflecting as you were talking. So many different companies will say, and leaders will stand up and say, you know, our people are our most valuable asset. Right. Yeah. And then in the context of a transaction, they wouldn't show their most valuable asset. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's a Hobson's choice, but especially if you got really good people, you want to parade them out front. And yeah, it could mean some disruption, but I don't know how else better to do it. What's next for you personally, professionally? I mean, I got a feeling you're going through 100 more companies, and I'm sure your current employer does not want to know that. But
maybe it's 100 miles an hour with the same company. But you know, I'll tell you, Dave. Right now, I'm really enjoying my time with CDC. I get to work with people that I respect and people that I can learn from. You know, I learn something every day. I'm really excited about our growth prospects for the future. I mentioned the diversity of our end markets, and learning about new markets is exciting to me. We're having a fantastic year, and I'm having fun. I'm having fun right now. So I really can't ask for anything more professionally. And you know, you mentioned it, I think, on the lead in. My family loves being here in Kansas City. We've been here for a little over 10 years now. I've got two grown children that both live in Kansas City, so life's pretty good.
Well, I hate to say it for our listeners throughout the country, but we like to keep our little secret about Kansas City very quiet. We love the rest of the country, but y'all don't have to move here. Listen, I want to thank you, Mike, for spending time with us. Be sure to learn more about Continental Disc Corporation, and I believe this is right, Mike. It's at www.contdisc.com.
That is correct.
And how would they get a hold of you if they would want to talk to you?
So my email address is mwaters@contdisc.com.
Great. Really appreciate that. If you're in search of assistance for a situation, much like Mike, where he is finding opportunities and growing businesses for not only his employer, but also for himself as an owner, please go to davidsider.com and schedule a free consultation. And if you would, also please subscribe to the show, rate it, and leave me a comment on your favorite podcast platform, such as Spotify or Apple. I want to thank you again and thank all my listeners. We will be in touch soon. I know that there'll be more interesting folks to bring to you, and as always, the feedback is really appreciated. Goodbye until next time. This podcast is provided for educational purposes. It does not constitute legal advice and is not intended to establish an attorney-client relationship. The recommendations contained in this podcast are not necessarily appropriate for every individual or business in determining the best course of action. Business owners should consult with an attorney on their distinct circumstances.